Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Haley Painter, the co-CEO and co-founder of Painterland Sisters, an organic skyr yogurt company that also happens to be my favorite new product in years. Haley and her sister Stephanie returned to their fifth-generation family farm in Pennsylvania to support the family business. And in 2022, the sisters began packaging their thick, creamy yogurt in cups. And the rest is history. Welcome, Haley.
Hi, Allie. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. Before we get into sort of like the zaniness of like the last 18 months or whatever it was since you put your like, you know, ambrosia into a cup and started selling it, can you, I think you might be sort of the first actual family farmer who has a product. I did have the founder of Stonyfield Farm on, but even he wasn't like the farmer. So I'd love you to give a little background on sort of state of agriculture, family farming in particular, and I think really even narrower, like what's kind of been going on in the dairy industry in the last several years that you and Stephanie are sort of on a mission to, you know, solve, I guess, in your own way.
Yeah. So the dairy industry is such a fun industry to be in. We're so happy. We're fourth generation on our farm. The fifth generation's running around. And the cool thing about family farms is it allows family members to work and play together. So we kind of grew up running around, feeding the calves, feeding the cows, hiking up the hills to bring those cattle in. Working the crops and the soils and doing all the things. And we thought it was just, you know, fun and games, but it was actual work too. Yeah. And so we really get to, as family farmers, you get to be around your family while really creating a difference and making a product for the rest of the world to enjoy. I didn't realize how special it was.
Yeah.
At all. Like, you just kind of grew up on it. And since then, we found out 2% of the country is actually directly involved in agriculture.
Yeah. And I remember in my, because I, you know, I did this master's program at the beginning, I believe, of the 20th century, that number was closer to like 60%. So like in the last 100 or so years, it's gone from, I mean, it might have even been higher. It went from like pretty much over, like significantly over half to 2%. That's like a massive shift in how we get our food and the food system in general.
It is such a huge shift. We have fun facts in the back of our yogurts. And one of those is in the 1850s, nearly every family had a cow. So like a family cow. And I think we can all say we don't, even though the social media is going crazy where everyone wishes they had a family cow now.
With the blowout.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's my kids are sending me all these like blow dried cows because my dog looks a little bit like a blow dried cow. And so it's very funny. But there's been, I mean, dairy has gotten, you know, sorry to say it, but like its ass kicked in the last couple of years with, you know, a lot of stuff going on. And I know that you guys were not untouched by that. So what was the sort of, you know, mission for you guys? What were you working to turn around a little bit?
Yeah. So although the dairy industry is such a needed thing, agriculture is really the backbone of our country. And I think we forget that as a society.
Totally.
And in the, you know, past couple decades, you know, in the early 2000s, we were really struggling with animal rights activists. It was all about the animals and giving them a voice and making sure that we were treating them well. And the family farm and dairy farmers specifically got probably the worst wrath. And then in the early, you know, what's happening now, it's all about the soil and mm-hmm. climate change. That really was in the early, like probably 2015, that was really aggressive about how dairy farms and dairy cows are one of the leading factors in the climate problems. And today, we are finally getting some traction where, okay, the dairy cow is not to blame for that. Mm-hmm. Dairy, like an animal husbandry, is so great from these family farmers. And there's a difference in different types of industry.
Right.
And dairy cattle can actually give back to Mother Earth, can create a viable future and sustainability. The huge hot topic right now is carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we get carbon out of the air? And grazing cattle and these old dairy farms are great at that because mm-hmm. these cattle walk up these hills where we can't live. Humans can't put houses. We can't grow corn and soybeans and plant-based products. But cattle can graze and take really poor nutrient like foods mm-hmm. And grasses and turn them into a value-added, really nutrient-dense product for the rest of the world to consume. And it's very bioavailable. And yep. it's just cool because we're starting to get better traction. But as far as like the struggles in the industry, the dairy industry, it's a crisis of what's happening.
Yeah.
It's like the last 10 years, something like 1,700 dairy farm families yeah. have went out of business.
Yeah.
And that's not by choice no. all the time.
No, for sure. It's interesting because again, everyone hears me talk about like, I'm 51. Like, I think I say it almost every podcast, but I think part of the challenge that we have now is like, you know, with social media, everything is made so reductive. Glass is good. Plastic's bad. Like, that's just not always the case, you know?
Yeah.
Plant-based everything is good. You know, animal products bad. I mean, mm-hmm. clearly that we know now that that's just a load of, you know, crap. Like there's a lot that's just like, it's made too simple. And usually these things don't include the voices of the people that are actually doing it well. You know, they're just the loudest voices. And one thing that I remember when, you know, and this was like 2012, 2014, 2015, like there was so much discussion about the animals and then there was discussion about the land, but there is still so little discussion about the people and the labor. And,
yes.
You know, and it's fascinating to me that we as a culture have learned how to sort of understand the value of a better product, but we haven't really started to understand the value of better practices among labor. Like we don't as a culture pay for that. And it's kind of part of the bigger problem that we're facing today, I think, in a lot of ways.
I think so too. It's these extreme concepts. Mm-hmm. So again, in the early 2000s, it was all about the animals and now it's all about the soil.
Yeah.
And if you heavily focus on just one aspect, you're going to kind of
balance.
Yeah, mm-hmm. completely.
Yep.
And so what we haven't focused on is exactly right. Our communities. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to a farm to be 100% have the best cattle, you're going to suffer the soil and the communities because you're putting all your energy into that. But what we truly believe in is symbiotic relationships amongst the people, the communities, the soil health, mm-hmm. And the animal health, right. Because with that, that's when you can really create a strong return. It might not be the best yield. It might not have the most amount of protein. It might not be able to completely give back to the soil as much, but it'll do everything way more sufficiently. And with right. that, we can be more sustainable altogether.
Yeah. And so it seems like, you know, me sort of like sifting through, it seems like you and Stephanie kind of had, I would say, two missions. And tell me if I'm wrong. One is you wanted to create a product that brought in some value add into the farm, right? Like you didn't just want to sell the milk to co-ops anymore. And correct me if I'm wrong. You wanted to make a product that you had more control over that brought in extra revenue.
Yes.
And then secondly, you really wanted to do this larger mission of connecting consumers with your farm and your story, but family farms in general, and to sort of break down that misunderstanding when people think about agriculture. There's a vast difference between the people that are doing family farming like you are and sort of more industrial, you know, corn to ethanol farming that, you know, people is not even really, I don't even know if you can call it agriculture, but whatever. Would you say those are sort of like the micro mission and the macro mission?
Yeah, exactly. So we just set out, how do we keep our farm sustainable for generations to come? Mm-hmm. And with that, it expanded out our farm and the other farms in the area, because that really is what will provide community support in the industry to really thrive. And then additionally, how do we connect consumers to the direct source of their food, the American farmer? You know, people want a transparent product. They want real nutrients, and they want the most amount of nutrients that they can get. They don't want products that are being diluted and byproducts being sold off. And so we just wanted to provide this connection to empower consumers and farmers and bridge that gap, because there's way too many of us in the middle between mm-hmm. brands and distributors and stores. Like mm. we just really need to do a better job. How do we connect the people eating the food and the people making the food?
Yeah, not that complicated.
Empowering both. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was like, missions. And you're like, or you could just do this. Yeah. One last question before the break. Can you just explain the difference between Skyr, Greek yogurt, Persian yogurt, all the yogurts?
Yeah. So dairy has always been a really nutrient-dense food, but it's so perishable. And so yogurt has been made in all different regions throughout our world as a way to preserve milk for a longer time. And yeah. so each area kind of had different techniques to preserve it. And we know about regular yogurt isn't really strained. It's a little thicker, or it's a little thinner. Right. And then Greek yogurt came along. And we're really well exposed to, it's a strained type of yogurt. Mm-hmm. And so you take your regular cultured milk, which is yogurt, and you strain out the water. And so it makes it thicker and all those nutrients more concentrated. Right. The difference between Greek and Icelandic are the different types of cultures being used to actually sour, you know, create that thickness in the milk. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, the process that we filter or we strain out the water is different. So a lot of the Greek yogurts in our country spin it really fast to take right. the water out. It's called centrifuging. Mm-hmm. And then the Icelandic technique that was made in Iceland in the 90s is called ultrafiltration. So we actually filter out the water, and we are able to keep a lot more of the nutrients, like all of the micronutrients, all of the whey protein, which is actually lost in the process of making Greek yogurt here right. on a large scale in the country.
Yeah. I mean, it's really delicious. I just want to throw that in. And I'm not like a huge yogurt eater. I have one yogurt that I'm obsessed with. It's called White Mustache. And it's like my friend who's, it's Persian. It's like Iranian yogurt. And she literally hand strains pretty much like every batch. Uh-huh. So it's not exactly scalable. It is amazing. But this comes so close. You know, this is like really good stuff that you can scale, which is the point. Okay, I'm going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're going to talk about everything since you guys decided to, hey, let's make a yogurt.
Perfect.
We'll be right back. I'm back with Haley Painter from Painterland Sisters. Okay, so product is amazing. You have a very good mission for your family farm, for your community, for family farmers in general. And so you and Stephanie were like, yep, let's do this. And then what? I mean, what? It's not easy getting a product off the ground. Like you said, there are so many pieces who take what, you know, people call a bite of the apple. It everything is like overly complex, even though, you know, it is complex. But I mean, it's amazing that in 2023, this is the system that we use to get our food. And yet I have no alternatives to a better system. So it is what it is. But, you know, sales and distribution, what were the big learnings there? What would you say are some things that you wish you had known earlier? And, you know, how long is your shelf life and how much does that impact stuff?
Completely. So when we got into this, we had no understanding of this industry. Yeah. Our industry is the CPG industry, consumer packaged goods. Mm-hmm. We found out that term like 4 months after launching a CPG company.
Yeah.
We were by far very disconnected. We use a co-manufacturer to make our yogurt. We didn't know what that was.
Right.
And so we really learned as we went. You get a lot of consultants and advisors. They're great to give you different perspectives, but ultimately, like, making the decision to follow your original vision, mm-hmm. keep going, is how we've kind of navigated through all these crazy rides in this world. And honestly, it is such a crazy industry. I wish people just understood starting your own company in the food industry.
Yeah.
It is like wild.
Well, it's funny because when I started this podcast, it was very much like, you know, what I always say is like, it's not how I built this, but like, how on earth am I going to build this? And after 5 years of doing it, I feel almost like it's like how to not drive yourself totally insane, spend millions of dollars, and then be very sad. Like that's basically what I would like to title it. And I don't know, like times like these, you know, it's hard to sound super optimistic, even when things are going great and people love your things. It's still hard. You know, you would think that those two things would be a little bit more connected. Okay, we have a product that's really selling that people really love. It should be super. Now we're going to just go up and to the right. But that doesn't seem always the way it goes. So, you know, talking to yourself before 2022, what would you say, like, these are a couple things, like, you need to know, you know, earlier me?
I think I'm so tickled with the decisions we've been made. Tickled is like a word my grandma uses.
It's a good one because it's very lovely.
But
I'm harassed and itchy by the decisions I've been made, but I'm glad you're tickled. That's great.
Well, I feel really fortunate because we didn't know the industry. And it's really when you go into an industry that does have a lot of obstacles and opinions, mm-hmm. and this is how you do it. We came from such a different world. Like, okay, we're farm girls. We know how to think outside the box. We only know how to think outside the box. So when people try to put us in a box, it makes it a little difficult for us. And so we've really led with just trying to answer our vision and our mission. How do we get this thing going for generations to come? Mm-hmm. Like, what's best for our consumers? What's best for us? And we just ask everybody. And we are just very open, authentic. And I'm just so like when we first started, we did not know that. So our minimum, our shelf life is only 60 days, mm-hmm. 2 months.
Yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
Because our minimums are around 60,000 units mm-hmm. a week.
Right.
And so we went from 0 to 100 and we're like, all right, our Pennsylvania small community can eat 60,000 yogurts a week. And we quickly realized, all right, we'll have to expand statewide. They'll be able to eat it.
Right.
And then we got region-wide, and 2 months later, we were selling national because we need national support in order to consume 60,000
right.
yogurts every single week. So, like, that was one of those naive moments we had, and we've had so many.
Yeah.
But, like, we're not to the point where we're looking back thinking, all right, what could we have done differently? I wish we would have done that. Because we are, like, full-on sprinting in the rain, holding our pants up because our belt dropped. Like, we are just going, so we can't fully, like, look back and think about it yet.
Yeah.
But I'd say our biggest thing is just keep asking people. Just keep knowing your worth, knowing that no one has done this before.
Yep.
Take everyone's perspectives and just keep moving and pivoting.
Yeah.
Because something will break. Something will come up. There's opportunities. You might think of the same problem every single day. And then by the, 60th day in the middle of the night at 2 a.m., you find a solution.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that a lot of this is just, sometimes I wish that, I guess the point is like, there really are no shortcuts. There's no hacking it. There's no, way to really save going through the process. It's kind of like you can tell a kid, don't jump on the bed. You're going to fall off the bed. And until they actually just fall off the bed and they're like, oh, I shouldn't jump on the bed. Like, it's very hard for anybody to know how to help a new company. Even, I would say there's probably some major things, like you want to have gross margins that make the whole thing viable at all. It's just trial and error, really. But going back to, I was thinking about it when I was writing out the questions. And again, tell me if I'm wrong here. But it feels like, had you all launched this when money was flowing and VCs were all over everything and everyone was a consumer investor, it almost might have set you up, almost not the right way. Like, the fact that this is a strange time in the world of funding and that everyone is so focused on those margins and profitability means that it's cool now to think that way. And is there something that's been actually kind of like positive for you? Because you are building, you're not building something to scale really quickly, grow, and then, sell. From my understanding, you're really trying to build the next 5 generations of your family's business. You're just trying to understand the best way to do that for today's world. I mean, is that too simple?
No, I think it's actually super correct. And I didn't know the industry before this. I mean, I obviously know.
It's hard to find investors. Yeah.
I didn't really know because I wasn't really looking for investors before. Mm-hmm. We've been financed through, bank loans, and the percentage rates have increased like crazy. Like, that's been really rough.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think we're a little too young to realize how good that we could have had it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's better.
But while we're looking for investors, like, our goal, and we're talking to different companies, our goal is, how do we become profitable? How do we keep this around for generations? And talking to other founders, there's a lot of mindset that's like, how do I find the niche, scale this thing, and sell it, like, have all my hard work pay off. And that is a very common mindset in our industry that I was very surprised to hear about. I think it's something like 90% of the food on the grocery store shelves is owned by 10 companies. And to me, that like diversity creates stability, and we really need diversity. We need more brands that are around for a long time. We need investors that want to support that, and they want to have an out that is, you know, distributions of profits, dividends, you know,
figuring like out how to sell the share. Business, right?
And then we'll all be actually way more lucrative in the long run, financially, impactfully, all of the above. And so that's how we've always wanted and sought out, you know, our company. We'd love to have funded it totally ourselves or through debt financing. But having this supplement of looking for investors right now, it's actually opened so many doors and connections. How we decided to do it was through crowdfunding, and everyone's like, why would you do that? Well, that way we can really connect. We can, we're able to advertise that we're looking for investors. We're able to be transparent about what we're doing, and it's led to the coolest connections. And we probably have like 270 investors. Some of them are grocery store chain owners. Some of them own distribution centers, some of the largest ones. And it's just really cool to now have these connections because of being able to use our voice very freely.
Yeah. And it also goes back to, you know, the building community is a real mission. And there's a, there is a transparency. It's almost like, I mean, people are coming to build your barn, literally. And, no, I mean, like, it is, it's beautiful, you know.
And then we can all stay in it.
Right. And you're not building it like cheaply and too fast to miss building it on a very sturdy foundation. And I think that's what's happened, you know, in a lot of, you know, unfortunate scenarios in the last several years, you know, and I think a lot of that is shifting, which is a good thing net net, but, you know, challenging in a lot of ways too. I feel like you also, you know, you all also sort of tapped into agricultural grants. Is that right at the beginning?
Yeah. So we applied for grants at first because we didn't know anything about, you know, writing a business plan or again, what a CPG world was or anything in this industry. So tapping into grants that we found through our communities actually helped us get enough funding to hire the experts to help us with our business plans, presenting what we wanted to do and craft our opportunities. And we just actually recently got a larger USDA grant and are going to continue to go after some of these agriculture opportunities.
Very cool. And I think one of those, you know, there are grants there. I mean, there are packaging grants, there are sustainability grants, you know, they take some weeding through and, you know, a little bit of administrative, you know, nightmare, but I mean, they do exist. And I feel like that's something that is a little bit underutilized. Even if you're, you know, if you were coming up with a system that is more sustainable at a co-packer and there's a machine and you can make a case to, you know, whether it's the state of New York in my case or the state of Pennsylvania, that that will be good and keep jobs in New York or whatever. There are these things. It's just a stone that I don't know that a lot of people know to look under. And you're, you know, there are a lot of them that don't necessarily apply, but you know, where your offices are, where your co-packer is, what kind of equipment you need to invest in, how many jobs you're producing, what kind of materials you're using. You know, are all of your ingredients locally sourced? Are you a woman-owned company or a minority-owned company? Like, I've just been, it's just something that I want people to put in their back pocket a little bit. Because,
I think so too.
You know, they're out there. Okay, I want to go back to sales for a second. So going back to, okay, you were like, yay, we made this yogurt. We have 10,000 or 60,000 of it a week to sell. Or is that what you said?
Yeah, that's kind of our minimum. All right. Our co-packer helped us. So he lowered it for the first couple months. But yeah, that's his ideal minimum.
Okay. So So how, what did you, you know, where did you start? And what kind of infrastructure, I guess, have you built out to sell it nationally and, you know, get into those new stores? And I guess the second sort of follow-up question to that is, I would imagine that buyers would love you and love the story and love the product, but I would also imagine that the yogurt shelf is sort of spoken for by a couple of the very big players. And I'm wondering how hard that has been for you, like to really make the case to come in, to be something new, to be a little bit more premium, to have less marketing dollars. You know, it is a big category, and I feel like it doesn't have a lot of players.
It does not. It's one of the most saturated places in the grocery store shelves. It's really highly competitive. Mm-hmm. And we knew that going in. So we always led with, how do we lead with quality? How do we lead with what we're good at? And focus on that. So I guess our target wasn't, how do we get the largest? Mm-hmm. Even though we are now the fastest growing yogurt company in the natural grocery channels year over year. So that's really a good side effect of just following with like focusing on premium and what we can offer. And so we crafted a product that we felt was the most nutrient dense, was the most transparent, was woman owned, was farmer owned. We knew the source of the milk. There's very few that could check off the boxes like ours. And then on top of it, we added billions of probiotics, a really expensive strain. Mm-hmm. And we made it lactose free because 65% of our country has a lactose sensitivity. So we crafted something really pure. Mm-hmm. And that we knew could lead. And then we had our hands on our creative marketing on the actual label. So each label is actually a coloring page on the back. Mm. And we went through like probably over 150 re-editions of that dang label.
Right.
Because it's so small. Like, how do you really make it stick out?
Right,
so
right.
We wanted like our feminine, natural voice to pop out when consumers saw it on the shelves. So how we got started was we started with country stores in Pennsylvania and then expanded out to Giant. Giant's our local conventional mm-hmm. grocery store chain here, but they really supported us for our farmer owned PA preferred routes. Then we got connected with Central Market. Mm-hmm. And shortly after, probably 4 months after launching our product, we became national with Natural Grocers. Mm-hmm. The month following, you know, within 5 months, we became national with Sprouts. And that opened the doors to the large distributors, distributor Kahee, and then Albert's Organics. We continued to expand within the first 12 months of selling our first cup of yogurt. We sold $1.3 million worth of this stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Now we're a little over a year and a half old, and we're in almost 2,000 stores nationwide. We use both Kahee and Unify. We're in their diversified trade programs, Up Next programs, and try to participate in as many, I guess, impact awards opportunities there are, the Pitch Slams, the Nexty Awards.
I know. I was really annoyed that you guys didn't win the Pitch Slam that I met you at. I literally, when you all went to the Pitch Slam, and Stephanie was very pregnant, so I was like, there are these two beautiful farm women that are like literally selling the most beautiful product on the planet. Like, there's no way they're not coming home with a big dub. But I don't know. We don't even have to talk about who did because I didn't even ask, but that was annoying. But yes, you should win every award. It has all of the pieces and parts of what people want to win, you know, a great story, a great mission, a great product, you know, all of that, you know. I mean, I guess that leads me to sort of, you know, the second piece is going back to, you know, connecting the consumer with the family farm and connecting the consumer with your farm and your community. A lot of that, I would imagine, is done through content. You walk outside or you film a cow or you show whatever. But Are you finding it? I find it hard. I guess the question is, do you agree? Sometimes the connection between the people that love you online and follow the story and open the emails, even if they want to, sometimes it's hard to get that connection to in store. You know, it's like people talk about sort of digital space. Like there are all these programs and like Aisle is one of them, right? Where they're trying to connect sort of the way that people consume content and the way that people look for new products is digitally. But, you know, then they get to a store and there's a gazillion things on the shelf and you have a couple of SKUs there and it's a little more expensive. Like, did that surprise you the way that it surprised me? Do you find it's like once it's on the shelf, it just kind of rolls off and everything's honky dory? Are there things you're learning about, you know, where it does better than other stores or who it does better when it's next to or, you know, all of that?
It's been, like I said, a crazy ride.
Yeah.
Getting on shelves, it's the hardest part, not selling into the stores, but making sure that the stores are stocked, not because we don't have great inventory.
Yeah.
It's, you know, as a small startup brand in a perishable world, and it moves fast, right? The velocities, the pickup in yogurt, you get a lot of sales. Really quick, I was talking to a pickle company at our last trade show, and they were talking about how often they make product and how many like velocities they move a week. And I'm like, this is such a different world.
it's crazy.
Focused on so many different things. So really our focus is on how do we keep double checking that our product's actually on these shelves, like it's getting from these distribution warehouses to a place where consumers can pick it up and buy it. And once it's there, consumers really love it.
Right.
We're getting a lot of great feedback. It's this wave of, we call them sisters. We have the sisterhood of people that are really excited to try it across the country and really loyal followers. We just have to keep on, you know, the supply chain of, hey, let's get this thing stocked. Why are you out of stock? What's happening here?
Yeah.
Because as a small fry in a big industry, it's easy to be forgotten about. And so we spend a lot of time, you know, checking on other people.
Hounding UNFI. That's what a lot of us spend a lot of time hounding UNFI. We're like, wait, how come velocity has gone up 20% year over year, but we're, you know, UNFI ordered less this month, you know, what, what's the disconnect? And honestly, every month I'm like trying to figure out, is it us to them? No. Is it them to the retailer or not even, is it them to their own warehouses? Which warehouses is it? You know,
is it stores just stocking it? It's a bunch. And so like our biggest thing that we've done is like connections and networking are everything, including with, you know, our partners with the distribution chains. And so, we've had, at first it was difficult to navigate, but now we've set up like weekly and bi-weekly meetings with them. And so we can kind of work through them live because, they're using a lot of AI and systems like that. And so it just gives them a second chance to like kind of pay attention to a smaller brand that might get lost because when you're so new, you don't have time to get a good
system set up.
System, exactly. Yeah. So by working with them, by having those calls, it's really helped us kind of everyone manage it a lot better.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. I mean, it just knowing what their inventory is, you know, I mean, knowing for us, it's a little different because it's, you know, if they, even though we're still fresh, we do have a little bit longer of a shelf life. So sometimes if their inventory, you know, if we see like three orders a month from Sprouts, let's say, we kind of know that the next month we're probably not going to see that again. They're probably stocking up for something or they're replenishing or something. But knowing that for every single, you know, one of your customers it's a lot of checking in and checking up and looking into the data and, you know,
oh,
demand
yeah.
planning and all of that. I think that's like one of the hardest parts.
We get orders every single week. Yeah. Some people like don't like some brands. I think that's the biggest thing you asked about. Like if you could tell yourself something, what would you tell yourself? It'd be like, do you have to get into perishable?
Right. I think everyone who's in fresh is like, oh, this is why people are like, oh, you know?
Yeah, but, it's a totally different world.
Yeah.
But our velocities can be right. so much better.
Totally. And I think the ring, you know, when you're high velocity and a little higher ring, you know that you're, you know, category accretive. And that seems to be the ticket, you know, as long as you also have the margin there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And going back to the content, you know, how are you all managing that? Like, is it just, do you and Stephanie just film your lives basically? I don't have Instagram, so I don't know. But how has that been for you? And where have you found that people are really engaging the most?
Yeah. Let me start with saying you are saving hours of your life not having Instagram.
No, I know. It was a conscious choice. And I was like on the wagon, off the wagon, on the wagon, off the wagon. And then finally I was like, I don't need to look at it. Thank goodness for work. Like my team is amazing. If there's something they want me to see, they will show it to me. And other than that, there's no scrolling for me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We have an awesome team as well who do a lot of our content planning. Mm-hmm. We use a lot of our voice through that. And so we do a series of photo shoots and video shoots a year that we can utilize for the quarter. And then the organic content, all the farm stuff that's organic, I pretty much take, or I get support with my family from, but I just go outside, snag a couple pictures of the fall leaves, throw it on our iPhone cloud photos, and then our team can just take it, splice it, add it up. Sometimes I'll add a quick story, but I like having a team that can support with that is awesome, but it's really brings a low budget when you're able to produce the content yourself.
Yes,
and be able
for
to
sure.
use storytelling.
Yep. Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, you have a real story to tell too, you know. I think a lot of businesses, you know, sort of following in the midday squares, you know, that sort of let's tell the story behind the founders and making it. And I think people are interested in that, but I think they've also seen that now a couple times before. And, you know, you can't beat cows. I just don't.
You can't be fluffy cows. Baby cows.
Yeah, that you definitely can't be baby cows.
Except for piglets. Yeah. People, I randomly throw a piglet in there and I'm like, oh, people are going to go crazy.
My friend Ellen has a pet pig and he's amazing. But that's another she's been on. What does your father think of this? I mean, ostensibly, you all came back from college and Stephanie from like a couple of years out to come and just help him run the dairy farm. And then you were like, hey, Dad, we want to make yogurt. Like how does the older generation feel about all of this?
My dad is so proud. When you think of someone with a twinkle in his eyes and a big jolly like grin and giggle, but who works excruciatingly hard day in and day out and thinks of himself last, that is my dad. And my whole family's really supportive of it. And he's just really proud. And the reason, like, he's known, we've been planning this since 2018. We didn't launch the product till 2022. So four years of planning is quite a lot.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to make sure we had the right niche in the system. And it was to ensure that our family had this voice and farmers and consumers have this voice to really connect. And so we wanted to make it right. So after I graduated college, I actually moved to New Jersey. I made cheeses and yogurts and I sold them in the farmers markets in Manhattan and Hoboken and a bunch of the markets around there. I would do demos in Whole Foods. And so I got a lot of experience. So he knew about it before that. It was just like, what product are we going to actually launch?
Right. Because it could have been cheese, I guess.
Oh, yeah. If you saw my background, I have a giant.
I saw before we went off of, yeah. I happen to eat a lot of cheese. I love cheese, but I'm marrying a man who is like obsessed with cheese. So my cheese world, you know, as an American who grew up in New York, I'd never had unpasteurized cheese. I never had cheese from a particular grass that only grew in one area for a month. You know, there's like,
mm-hmm. Eats lavender.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I didn't know it was, you know, it had all these like health qualities. It also has some saturated fat, but, I'm a cheese person myself, but was that on the table? Like, did you all have like a list of like dairy products that you could have made and you settled on Skyr?
We had multiple businesses plans before we fully launched this one. And the very first one we did, we had designed to make every single dairy product besides yogurt because I knew it was super perishable and I didn't like yogurt.
Right. That's so funny.
And so I had to make one that we really liked and that is the niche. The reason I don't like yogurt is I just don't like the yogurt on the grocery store shelves. Like, I like yogurt that I make on my stove.
Yep.
And so making one that was really pure was the niche that the country needed. And then we could really focus on one product and expand it out versus doing all the different products that we designed. We actually designed a processing plant. Got quoted out to $8 million before we ever even had a brand or sold anything. So we're like, maybe we just launch a brand first.
Right. Yeah. Are there other things that now you think you're going to make? Like, are you going to, you know, do freeze-dried yogurt chips or frozen yogurt or anything? I mean, you don't have to tell me exactly, but is there that type of plan, or are you sticking with yogurt for now?
I love how those are the first two you thought of, especially the freeze-dried yogurt chips.
Well, I was thinking I was thinking no fridge, no freezer. Oh. How do we make yogurt, you know, non-perishable and shelf-stable? And then I was thinking about little, I don't know, like, you know, like astronaut-style melt-in-your-mouth yogurt for babies, but
like
I don't
the cheese
even know if
wisps, but yogurt wisps.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
You know what? That business plan is coming to a bank near you. No, I'm just kidding.
Amazing. Exactly. Thank you so much. I don't know if there's an actual market for that, but it sounded good when it came out of my mouth.
It does sound good.
You think you're gonna keep in the yogurt game for a while?
We are going to expand out and really make sure that we're hitting our audience, our yogurt loving audience first, and then we'll see what the demand is after and where life takes us. Again, it's like we're just kind of running around and seeing where it takes you. There is a country song. It's a really, really country song. Uh-huh. But the one part of it says, it's like driving down the highway going 60 miles an hour and then checking the steering wheel out the window. I feel like that's what this is. So we'll see where the path goes.
Well, I think on that note, there's nothing better that I could end with other than the visual of throwing the steering wheel out the window. You might be going 90 miles an hour. That's the only thing. Maybe not just 60. But Haley, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been so much fun. I'm so rooting for you guys, and I hope you know that. I think you know that. And I'm just so excited to see this product in the world and to see what y'all build. And I'm just happy for you. So thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, Allie. There's a lot more journey in the future as we continue to cross paths.
Yes, totally. And Armin, as always, very much appreciate you engineering and being flexible on timing. You are the best. Couldn't do it without you. Thank you. And listeners, I have not been posting a lot on LinkedIn. You've probably noticed that if you are interested in me at all. Just feels like a weird time in the world to be talking about, you know, CPG. So I do appreciate the DMs, and I appreciate a bunch of you have reached out and been like, everything, where are you? I'm okay. All is well. I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.